When we wrote The Complete History of America Abridged in 1992, there was this thing called political correctness just beginning. And so I wrote our politically correct national anthem. And here we are in the year of our Lord 2016 on the 4th of July. And doesn't it seem like political correctness is making a comeback a little bit?
Well, it depends on what you call it.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or tablet or phone. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, number 499, on political correctness.
Beautiful for spacious skies and non-exploited waves of botanical companions.
James Finn Garner is the author of the classic book of humor and satire, Politically Correct Bedtime Stories, and its various companion volumes. We've gotten to know each other here in Chicago, and he was good enough to sit down with me over the 4th of July weekend and discuss not only his books, which also include the Rex Coco Private Clown series of comic mysteries, but the whole notion of political correctness itself.
Back in the day, political correctness back then was sort of redefining things in a linguistic point of view. Today, I think it's just out-and-out racism and sexism.
Yeah.
But without the any kind of gloss on top of it.
Right. It might be politically correct. It might be politically incorrect to say this, but no, it's not politically incorrect. It's racist or sexist.
I used to get that. It's like people would pull me aside at, say, a reading or a bookstore or something, and they would say, well, you know, it's not politically correct to say this, but they steal more chains than they can swim with. But it's kind of like... But it was always something that awful. It was always,
right.
They would pull me aside as if they're conferring something really wise to me.
Yeah.
And you just look at them and go, okay, fine. You know, it's.
Well, and I remember because I was working for a real theater in New Hampshire in the late 80s and early 90s when this began, when a sense of revisionism is one way to say it, or maybe a sense of inclusion was beginning to hit the dominant white populace, where everybody kind of began to go, oh, wait a second, maybe we're not the only ones who we should be thinking about.
Pretty dominant in New Hampshire, I would say that.
Still.
I think it's been fascinating. I've been trying to, when we talked about talking about this, it's been 23 years since my book came out, Politically Correct Bedtime Stories. I wrote them in the early 90s, very early 90s, and I was just trying to have some fun with double talk and double think and that kind of thing. And also, if you had to rethink bedtime stories or fairy tales, which were very, you know, had their awful tropes in them,
yeah.
And you rethought them, could you have fun with it? Could you get to the end of a story? And so I was making fun of double think. But in the meantime, in the past 20 years, there's been an explosion in culture of other viewpoints, which are not tied to linguistic twists and turns.
Right.
They are like, hey, I don't care if you're how you describe things. If you're a feminist, you know, you don't have to be a vagino American or something. But if you're a feminist, and I talk to my kids who are in high school and college now, and it's second nature to them. This revolution of thinking about the marginalized groups who are being more mainstream.
Well, absolutely, and 100%. I mean, even back in the early 90s when people started using the phrase political correctness, I was just thinking, well, at the worst, it's just not being politically correct. Just stop being a dick.
Exactly.
You know? Just all right, well, they're trying to, if they want to get rid of the Confederate flag, well, the Confederate flag is kind of a hateful symbol. So, and if you flying it means you're being a dick.
I'm a victim of political correctness because I'm just not. I just don't care. Don't care what you have to say.
Yeah,
so
I just don't care.
The hell with you.
I just don't care. Yes, I mean, and right now in 2016, in this election year, we have Trump and his ignorant racist followers. Wait, what's a nicer politically correct say ignorant racist followers?
I say intellectually challenged. Cranially boned.
Cranially boned. Caucasio normative.
Yeah, just God love them, but because somebody's got to. I haven't thought up a euphemism for them yet.
Right.
Neo-clan revisionists, I suppose. You know, they're like,
sure.
You know, the looking at white power, the weird. I think the weirdest thing that's come out of the past 2 or 3 years is the idea of white fragility.
Yes.
I think that's just fascinating.
Yeah.
That, you know, people are asked to consider other points of view and they freak out. Yeah. I mean, white people, they just freak out. It's like, we can't talk about this. Like, why not? You've had 300 years of talking about it, 400 years dominating the conversation, and now we can't even discuss it.
Well, and I think white fragility is exactly the root of the current strain of racism, because even poor white people who never had much power to begin with are going, well, wait a second, they're taking away my power. A, you never had it.
Yeah.
But B, yes, the U.S. and the world, I guess, is becoming more multicultural. You know, if God didn't like many cultures, he wouldn't have made so many of them.
Right. And it's not a covert plot. It's been happening. If you opened a paper once in a while 15 years ago and saw where demographic trends were happening, you would see it.
Yeah.
You would also see trends about economic development and that kind of thing that, you know, the people are screaming about keeping immigrants out, but it's like they're not costing us the jobs. It's technology is costing jobs.
Right.
So direct your anger at really what's happening.
Right.
Instead of finding scapegoats to do it. But that we're great at scapegoating.
We are. And the nice thing is, and you alluded to it before, is that old racist white folks are dying off, and it's the next generation of kids who are kind of way more comfortable with issues of gender fluidity, to use a phrase, and multiculturalism, and so that becomes a thing that we don't have to, hopefully, fingers crossed, looking on the bright side, there'll be a lot. I think there will still be, getting back to the politically correct bedtime stories, your book, there will be time again to come to the return to the fun of these sort of linguistic hoops that we all jump through.
Yeah, that was the reason I did it in the first place. You and I are old enough to remember when it was a big deal when they had blacks on primetime television.
That's right.
That it was a huge breakthrough, and they gave one a show. You know, they gave Diane Carroll a show.
Yeah.
And to explain that to anybody who's younger than 30, they just look at you cross-eyed. They just cannot figure out why this would be an issue.
Right.
And yeah, so let's get rid of old people like you and me, because it's like,
try to get us on the right side of history, not the white side of history.
Exactly. I remember when tokenism was very obvious in advertising and in shows and in Sesame Street, and now it's So there's like two generations since you and I were kids.
Right.
And like, so the tokenism sunk in. Then we had maybe a generation that was aware of it. And now a generation who just maybe is hyper aware of it and doesn't care.
Yeah.
You know, and like my kid in high school, the questions of inclusive bathrooms, you know, they've been talking about it in the Chicago Public High School she's at ever since she was a freshman. So it's and nothing, you know, it's like, oh, and my friend Sean, he's going through the change. It's like, really? Is it a physical thing? What is it? The transition.
Right.
They talk about the transition, and it blew my mind in a good way. It's kind of, you know, it's different.
But again, you and I shouldn't be that blown away by it, because we watched Ally McBeal. They had a unisex bathroom there.
Yeah. Well,
if we go and back, the world didn't explode.
If you go back in history, say let's go back to the 300 years ago, all bathrooms were gender neutral. They were a hole in the ground. They were just an oak. Hut in the back, you
That's
know.
Right.
If you were lucky, if not, it was a pot in the bathroom.
That's
or
right.
A pot in the bedroom. So
or let's all go down to our water source and pollute it, shall we?
Yeah, everybody, just hike your skirts and breeches and just go at it.
And in the 23 years since you've written the politically correct books, have they ever gone out of print? They seem to be just steady and popular this whole time.
They're out of print in America for economic reasons, which is a way to say they printed too many copies and didn't sell them. But it's in print overseas, in Britain, Spain, I think France is still in print. And I always found that fascinating that it sold well overseas, because I don't know if the jokes translated. I don't know if they wrote them right.
Right.
I have no idea. I had one or two translated, or I asked a person in France to look at the stories, and he said, oh, yeah, we changed the endings a little bit to make them more French. And I don't know what that means. But we changed the, they just weren't quite right, so we changed them. It's like, fine. What do you know?
That's awesome. But that means your politically correct books were politically corrected for the cultures that they were being intended to be read.
My influence is abounding. Yeah, exactly. Just through all these people. But it's been, it got translated into Russian, Korean, didn't sell well in South Africa for some reason. And I'm not trying to brag. It's just like a weird, you know, global thing. And in Iran, they couldn't publish it without or what was the deal? There's no copyright law in Iran at the time this guy was writing me 15 years ago.
Okay.
And he said, you know, I'd like to translate it into Farsi with your permission. And if I don't get your permission, I'm going to do it anyway because there's no copyright laws. So I sent him an email. It said, you know, I guess you got me over a barrel. Let's go with it. And I just want to see some copies of it. And I get the copies eventually on this really, really bad paper. And the copies have my email as a foreword. Just like in English. So it's not even, whatever I said is recorded for history to this. Literally, like word for word, my email was the foreword to the book.
Congratulations. And I bet you didn't get paid for it.
I didn't get paid for it.
No.
I got like three copies of the book. Honor thee and made you more of a non-speciesistic multicultural eco-warrior. From chronologically gifted anthropomorphized river to cosmetically enhanced sea.
This is Steve Smith, former director of Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Clown College, a short, bald, middle-aged man, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? This week, we're performing our first post-Folger performances of William Shakespeare's long-lost first play Abridged at Appalachian State University in Boone, North Carolina. Then we'll perform it again next month for the entire month of August at the Pleasance Courtyard at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And this fall of 2016, we'll be all over the U.S. performing our special election edition of The Complete History of America Abridged. Those dates are up on our website now. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReduceShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office venue and ticket information. And now back to my conversation with author James Finn Garner. What's fascinating about your writing is not only have you dealt with political correctness and issues of language and culture, but you have a whole series of books about a private eye clown, Rex Coco, private clown, which is just so right up or down the Reduced Shakespeare Company alley. It's kind of amazing.
Right down clown alley with you guys.
Yes, exactly. Where did that come from?
That arose.
Were you a clown?
No, I was not a clown.
Okay.
I was performing in Chicago, and three of us were doing fake radio shows. And we would do cliffhangers and Yukon adventures and Doctor's Hospital of Medicine. And they were fake, and we'd had sound effects that went wrong and scripts that screwed up. But our marquee character was Rex Coco, Private Clown, and we ended up with all this material from it. And I was looking around for a new idea for a book, and those were mostly just one-liners. They were just oral one-liners about clowns and people with fezes like Peter Lorre, which were terrible. So I started playing with the idea, and as I played with it, I looked in more into circus lore and such like that, and I realized that circus people were always outsiders, and I could create the friction between townies and kinkers to have a lot of fun with it, and also stick them in this kind of a ghetto like Chinatown,
right,
filled with washed up circus folks, and those washed up circus folks bring with them their superstitions, their hierarchy, their prejudices, their lore and history, and it just became this culture within a culture, and it just became really fun because then I can make this little alternative reality in this little ghetto with people who eat fire for breakfast. The fat lady runs the burlesque house. She's the world's daintiest fat lady. She's one of my major characters. There's a midget in the police force who's my hero's antagonist. There's monkeys running around. You know, there's escaped lions in the street, and no one makes a big deal about it.
Right.
And there's so much. It was so fun to jam up like old noir tropes and language and like get out of here on your getaway sticks and all these other kind of things, and mix that with the circus lore. Right. So we get, and they talk about Annie Oakley's and Abba Dabba and Cherry Pie and all this other stuff, and then you could put in Roscoe's and Getz and Dames and all that. So that was the linguistic fun of it.
Sure.
Because if I didn't have a word that I needed, I made it up. And
that's the fun. I mean, that's really one of the fun. I mean, there's on every page, there are these grace notes of this great private eye slang bumping up against circus slang. And in fact, you have a glossary in the back, which is very helpful sometimes.
Oh, I thought it was pretty clear, but people complained that I didn't have a glossary, so I inserted it in later editions.
Well, it's not that it isn't, for me, it wasn't clear, but it was just like, all right, what's the etymology of this, you know, of kinker? Like, I don't even remember what the etymology of kinker is.
Kinker is a general term for circus people, but it started as a name for acrobats because their bodies had, they worked their bodies so hard they needed massages all the time to get the kinks out of it.
Right.
Some of the other fascinating ones are an Annie Oakley is a free pass because back when Annie Oakley traveled with circuses, she would go to town to raise interest in the show, and she would throw a playing card in the air, shoot a hole through it, and if you caught that card, you got in free that night.
Wow.
And another term we use today is called make your nut. You know what it means to make your nut.
Sure.
You make your operating expenses back, and then it's profit. That came out of the circus world because sheriffs, when a circus came to town, would take the lug nuts off of the wagon wheels until they got paid off. So you couldn't leave town until the sheriff had his cabbage, you know, back there.
Wow.
Had his grease. And,
so you literally had to make your nut back.
You had to make your nut back. So it's phrases like that. And, you know, circus was a huge entertainment enterprise back. We forget how it used to be, but it used to be the only traveling entertainment in the country, except vaudeville.
Right.
But they would, like even General Pershing, Blackjack Pershing, went to Ringling Brothers and watched how they traveled in the 1910s to learn more for the Army, to how to make the logistics of moving that many people and food and equipment. The Army went to study Ringling Brothers.
Wow, that's really fascinating. Wow. That's really great. And are there three Rex Coco books now, or four?
There are three Rex Cocos. There's Honk Honk My Darling, which is the first one. Then Double Indignity, and then The Wet Nose of Danger, which involves stolen show dogs and blue-blooded ladies and Nazis and that pinhead in the book and parts the spoilers I gave you before.
And the pinhead is not Adolf Hitler?
No.
Okay, good.
There's no Hitler. We've had Hitler and other things. And now we're trying to turn this into a cartoon, into a Flash animation.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, online or on a series or something?
We're making it. We're trying to sell it online. Trying to sell it to a network.
Sure.
A cable network.
That's a great idea.
And we're taking Honk Honk My Darling and cutting it up a bit. And there's a professor of animation down at Columbia who wants to play with it. So I'm going to keep rolling with it. And, you know, it's funny. But making it really realistic is hard. Because I think then you just start thinking, oh, it's an asshole in a clown suit. But it's not.
It's not.
You know, he's a clown like an ethnic group. He's like deep down they're all clowns, and
they're like toons in Roger Rabbit.
Right.
Yeah.
And everybody all the circus people, this is what they love. This is who they are. It's not like they can get away, but it's who they are is eating them alive, and I think that's kind of the entertainer part that appeals to me. I think a lot of people in the world, even if they aren't in entertainment, are entertainers.
Yeah.
And they're kind of at war with who they are sometimes.
Right. Well, all the world's a stage, as someone once said.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the tricky thing too, particularly in a novel like this, or in these worlds that you're creating, where the tonal lines are so important because you have a mashup of so many different things. And in a novel, I get, because I've started reading the third Wet Nose of Danger, I get how serious and real Rex Coco is as a character. But if you don't get the right actor or the right director to invest that sort of depth and emotional truth in it, then it is going to be just this weird guy in a clown suit.
Yeah, he is trying to make amends for through his detective work for a tragedy everyone blames him for in the past that burned down a circus and cost people's lives.
Yeah.
And he's blamed for it. And the blame is misplaced, but it's all this other piled on stuff. And it's basically, not to sound too huge about it, but it's an existential story.
Sure.
It's like, what is he here for?
Yeah.
Why didn't he get taken? What's he going to do with the remaining years of his life to make any kind of amends for what he's seen?
And it's that 100% comes across, because otherwise it wouldn't. Who would want to read it? I mean, if it's just an asshole in a clown suit,
right? But he's an asshole who can't stop being an asshole. It's like It's like he'll walk into rooms and say non sequiturs or kick stuff over, and he's got to fly with that. But everyone sort of accepts that he's a clown detective.
Is it a little bit like, you know, when Roger Rabbit says, "Why didn't you could have gotten out of those cuffs at any time?" No, only when it was funny. You know, is that sort of the thing with Greg?
Yeah, it's that way. And he's there's a clown bar where all the clowns hang out, and they have to. It's their second nature.
Yeah.
So he'll say the wrong thing. He'll insult the wrong person. He will. Women jump on him constantly because women love a man with a sense of humor, so that throws a kink into it. I probably stole that from Kinky Friedman in his books. Cause somehow Kinky gets laid a hell of a lot for an old guy who smokes cigars all the time. You know?
Maybe I haven't gotten far enough in the book, and I don't know if this is a spoiler or not. But does Rex's makeup ever come off, or does he have makeup?
No, it's not makeup. It's him.
It's him.
It's him. His shoes are that big because his feet are that big. Right. And he's got hair that looks like a fox is falling asleep across the top of his head.
Right.
He's
not a man made up as a clown. He's a clown.
No, none of them are. They're all clowns. They're all Winky and Mr. Whoops and Punchy Punchinello are all clowns.
Yeah.
And I want to see how we animate the clown bar, because the clown bar is always debris, because every little disagreement ends in a clown fight.
Right.
And clown fights are hilarious, but they go to they never stop until you physically fall over. And the only other guy in the clown bar is the bartender, who they never get his name right, but he's he's like a little Bob Newhart behind the bar who will put on a catcher's mask and climb under the bar, and then the bar's, you owe me $5. Oh, that's what she said. Oh, and it goes, but it just explodes. And those are my favorite scenes of all.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Send us your politically correct clown slang via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also engage with us and other fans on Facebook or Twitter. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks, as always, to webmaster Matt Rippey, kinker Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Wendy Barnes. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Steve Smith, former Dean of Ringling Brothers Clown College and current creative director of San Francisco's Circus Center. And finally, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 499 1497ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
The books are for people who, like, if your boss calls you on the carpet and, asks you to explain these past quarter's figures, the only thing you can think to do at the board meeting is drop your pants. And we've all had that situation where, there's only one possible answer. Drop your pants.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. Reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less. So much less. So much less.